Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this lecture in the Senate Department's occasional lecture series. For those of you who haven't noticed, there's an election going on in the United States. For those who have noticed, I'm sure many of you are wondering what it is all about. Well, we have the best possible person to tell us about that today. Professor Jeffrey Garrett is the founding CEO of the United States Study Centre, which has been established in the University of Sydney. Has a very distinguished career in American studies, and as I say, the best possible person to cast some light on the subject for us. Please welcome him to the podium.
Thank you very much, and it's really my pleasure to be here. I'm sure virtually no one in the audience would believe me if I told you that I was actually born and raised in Canberra. It happens to be true, and I was saying before that when I left Australia to go to the US to do a PhD, I don't think they even decided whether there was going to be a new Parliament House, so it's always a real pleasure for me to come back to this beautiful building, and I wanted to thank you all for taking time out of a magnificent early spring day to listen to me ramble on about American politics. I was going to speak only about one disconnect that I see in the world relating to the United States today. That is a disconnect between expectations the world has for the next president and the likely realities of the next presidency. But I was struck earlier this week by a second disconnect as well, which became apparent in a global opinion survey commissioned by the BBC on how the rest of the world would vote if it could have a vote in the American presidential election. So I want to talk about both those disconnects together, if I might. So let me start with the headlines from this BBC survey that was released at the beginning of the week. The top headline said that the world prefers Barack Obama to John McCain by a whopping 4-1 margin. That is, if there was a global vote on who the next U.S. president should be, the outcome would be 80 Obama, 20 McCain. You will probably be interested to know that Australia was included in that survey, and Australia came out actually as the fourth most pro-Obama country of the 22 surveyed. The only countries that were higher on the list than Australia were Barack Obama's father's homeland. Proud Kenyans, I think, were going to vote Obama 97-3 or something like that. And then two other staunch bastions of anti-Bushism in what Americans disdainfully call old Europe. So the rank order of pro-Obama was 1, Kenya, 2, France, Americans would not be surprised to know that, 3, Italy, 4, Australia. Then the second part of the survey asked a follow-up question, which is, okay, what happens if either of these gentlemen is elected president? What will it do for America's international relations? And two-thirds of Australians said that the mere election of Barack Obama would improve America. Two-thirds of Australians said that the mere election of Barack Obama would improve America's standing in the world. Only 1 in 5 Australians said that the election of John McCain would improve America's standing in the world, which I think puts very neatly this distinction between Obama's slogan, change you can believe in, that the world clearly believes in, and the view that electing John McCain would be nothing more than a third administration of George W. Bush. That's global opinion. If you go to the United States at the moment, it's all McCain all the time. It's quite amazing. I think everyone's favorite political junkie website in the U.S., which I would commend to you all, is called realclearpolitics.com. Realclearpolitics.com this morning reports that if one aggregates the opinion polls as well as is possible, this is all the polls which are going on all the time, John McCain is currently leading Barack Obama in the opinion polls by 2 or 3 percentage points. If you break it down and look at the swing states, the critical parts of the U.S. on which the election will ultimately depend, McCain is also ahead in 5 of the 7 top swing states. And then if you think opinion polls are not worth very much, you might be more swayed, particularly since this is Australia where gambling is in the DNA, I think, by an organization called Intrade. Intrade allows you to bet on almost anything. And one of the things you can bet on is who's going to be the next U.S. president. And Intrade, for the first time in this entire election, interminable election season, has more money on McCain to win than Obama to win. So it's not just the opinion polls, the smart money. When people have to put their money where their mouth is, most of the money now is on McCain. So there is a profound mismatch between the person that the world wants to be the next U.S. president and the dynamics of American politics today. I want to try to explain why that mismatch exists, and I then would like to offer some conjectures about what it might mean after the next president is elected. So let me try to do both of those things relatively briefly, because I don't like listening to myself speak, so you probably don't either, and I'd love to engage in a conversation with you. But let me just see if I can make both of these points relatively briefly. Why would it be that the world wants change and wants Barack Obama elected president? I don't want to trivialize, but I just want to put to one side the fact that Barack Obama is an African-American with a middle name of Hussein. But I think it's extremely important, because if you look at Obama's impact, global impact, the Muslim world would clearly embrace this person as president, as would Africa, which views Obama collectively as its favorite son at the moment. But let's leave aside the developing world and only think about the disconnect between the U.S. and the rest of the Western world. I think the rest of the Western world, including Australia, really wants to turn the page on the Bush administration, and what better way to do it than to elect Barack Obama? I think that's about as simply put as I could make it. Now, I think, however, one needs to add a little nuance to that by making the observation that I believe sincerely to be true, which is that George Bush today is a much kinder, gentler president pursuing a foreign policy that is much closer to global norms than he's typically given credit for. The George Bush, the in-your-face unilateralism of 2002, 2003, 2004, has actually gone by the wayside a lot in the U.S. now. If you look at the policies that the Bush administration is pursuing in Iraq, in Afghanistan, North Korea, Iran, they're more or less the things, for example, that the Europeans wanted the U.S. to do. Withdraw from Iraq, more attention to Afghanistan, talk directly with North Korea, talk directly with Iran. The Bush administration just doesn't get much credit for that. Part of it probably is because people, including I'm sure many of you in this audience, made up your mind President Bush a while ago, and it's pretty hard to change your opinions. But I don't think the president has actually helped very much, because he steadfastly continues to say that his policies haven't changed, even though they have changed a lot. So The first observation about the rest of the West, if I might put it that way, is to say that Obama embodies change, McCain doesn't, and I think it's more or less as simple as that to explain why there's this Obama love fest. Now, the fact that the guy is a once-in-a-generation telegenic orator certainly doesn't hurt. But if you think back to 2004, the world was also very heavily behind John Kerry, who didn't share many of those attributes with Barack Obama, except for the fact that they're both extremely tall and very skinny guys. I remember standing next to John Kerry on a podium somewhat like this in 2004, and he was rail thin. You could almost see right through him. And he's in imperial measures, he's about 6 feet four. He's actually similar dimensions to Obama, but they're not the same person, certainly. So the world wants to move on. What's going on in the U.S.? My headline observation about the United States is that the United States is a profoundly different country today than it was in the year 2000. It is an anxious, insecure country. Not only in the national security context post-September 11, but also economically. The U.S. is in a serious economic downturn at the moment that is not only affecting Wall Street, it's affecting Main Street America too, because of the centrality of housing equity to the entire American economy. This is an economy driven by consumer spending. Americans love credit. The reason they're so happy to borrow money is because they think their houses are going to be worth more. When that bubble burst, not only did Wall Street go into turmoil, but Main Street got really panicked. And it got panicked at a time when inequalities of all types in the U.S. are unprecedentedly great. Not only inequalities in wages and incomes, but also access to health care and retirement benefits and things like that. So when I think about the U.S. 2008, I think not about the incredibly confident country that came out of the 1990s thinking that it had won the Cold War and the entire world had finally decided it wanted to be just like the U.S., I think of a country that is very anxious about its future at home and abroad. That's Obama's biggest problem, I believe, which is that even though much of the country is captivated, as the rest of the world is, in him and his candidacy, the United States collectively thus far has just not been willing to convince themselves to take the chance on putting Barack Obama in the White House. Up until very recently, this was an extraordinary election in that it wasn't what you would have thought, a referendum on the Bush administration, because if the election was a referendum on the Bush administration, Barack Obama would be destined to win. The Bush administration is unpopular, the president is unpopular, his party is unpopular, the Iraq war is unpopular, and the economy is in the tank. Political scientists would tell you that that's a guarantee of a clear Obama victory, and the sort of grind-the-crank models out there are still predicting that Obama will win 55 or 60% of the vote. That doesn't show up in the opinion polls, and I think the reason it doesn't is not because the polls are wrong, but because the models are missing this fact about the U.S., the anxiety factor. That means that the country wants a president it can be sure about, and they just don't think yet that they can be sure about Barack Obama. Some of that has to do with the fact that he is a young African-American man and blazing paths on both of those dimensions. Some of it has to do with the fact that he's very inexperienced and he just doesn't have a record of political accomplishment. He wins elections, but what has he done when he's won the elections is the question that's asked. But on top of that, he doesn't have a personal narrative that Americans can understand. The thing about the presidency is you're electing a person, not a party. And Americans have to, they don't necessarily have to like, although that helps a lot, they don't necessarily have to like the person they put in the White House, but they want to have an understanding of what makes the person tick, so that when the lights are off, when the cameras are off, and there's a tough decision to be made in the middle of the night, they can be confident that the person will make a decision that's in the national interest. I think that's how it's thought. This is John McCain's strongest suit. You might not like him, but you have to respect him because he has this record of accomplishment forged in the white heat of his 5.5 years of captivity in the Vietnam War. So on the one side, you have this John McCain who, you know, people might not like McCain, but they think they know who he is. People might be inspired by, energized by Barack Obama, but they're not sure who he is. And I think that that's a very important factor that goes into this otherwise pretty surprising tightness of the race. Now, that was always true, by the way. It's just not the case, even going back several months, that Barack Obama was way in front. The polls have always been stubbornly tight, but what's happened in the past couple of months is that McCain has done extraordinarily well and Obama has done really quite poorly. Let me try to explain that quickly. Obama went towards the Democratic convention starting to worry that this pizzazz and excitement that had carried him to the Democratic nomination was not going to be enough to win him the presidency. And his advisors were telling him that. So what did Obama do? He did two things that I think were really quite conventional, but that undermined the thing that made him Obama. The first conventional thing he did was to name Joe Biden as his running mate. Now, he did that because he needed to shore up his national security flank. People believed that, or they wondered, they worried, Barack Obama can't be commander-in-chief because he just doesn't have any experience. Obama response, I'm going to take Joe Biden, a 65-year-old man who spent more than half his life in the U.S. Senate, almost all of that time on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and much of that time as the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, I'm going to make him my VP, and that'll dull, blunt this Obama can't be trusted on national security charge. Second thing Obama did was he was told by his advisors, listen, the country just isn't getting this. You have a great slogan, change you can believe in, but no one knows what this change is. What you need to do in your acceptance speech at the convention is tell us what change is. And what Obama did in his convention speech was a long laundry list of pretty standard democratic fair domestic policy proposals that the Republicans could very easily characterize as big government Democrat. So, Obama, because he was feeling a bit weak, went conventional and conservative, both in picking Biden and in aligning his policies with a fairly traditional democratic agenda. That might not be a dumb move because these were two limitations he had, but what I think it did do was take some of the air out of this Obama balloon, which was, you know, it was more than hype. It was built on real excitement, but it was built on real excitement that he was different. And what he did was to say, I'm not so different. I've gone quite conventional. That, I think, then gave John McCain an opportunity. And because McCain is, I think, by nature a risk taker, he took that opportunity. The opportunity was, of course, in the now famous name of Sarah Palin. Now, one can try to play with clever images here. Mine would be that Obama pulled a cute fuzzy bunny out of the hat in selecting Sarah Palin as his vice presidential running mate, and they found that the cute fuzzy bunny, in fact, was a fantastic attack dog. As she said, a pit bull with lipstick. So you have this person now who is a lot of things that McCain isn't, telegenic, witty, a good connector with people, who was able, with a grin, ear-to-ear grin on her face, to go after Barack Obama in unbelievably tough ways in her acceptance speech at the Republican convention and do it to rave reviews. And I think the reason the reviews were such raves, by the way, is that expectations about her were so low because literally no one had ever heard of this person unless you lived in Alaska. And, you know, Alaska's a place that Americans sort of look at and say, gee, it'd be nice to go up there and look at polar bears, but it's, you know, there, I can't remember the precise number, but I think there might be 700,000 Alaskans. You know, that's not a lot of people in a country of 300 million that she's governing. And of course, that's her being governor of Alaska has only been for a couple of years. Before that, her sole experience was being mayor of a town of 9,000 people. So expectations were very low on Palin, and she just flew over them. Then the next day, McCain was now freed up. He didn't have to be a grumpy guy attacking Barack Obama because his vice presidential running mate had done it with her pearly whites visible the day before. So what McCain then did was say, I'm the agent of change because I'm going to take back Washington. And look, I'm going to show you that I'm an outsider. Even though I, John McCain, have been in the Senate for 26 years, I want to take back Washington, and the evidence that I'm going to do it is I would select somebody like Sarah Palin to be my vice presidential running mate. Now, this sort of 1-2 of Palin-McCain has clearly worked in the short term. It's not clear that it's going to work in the long term because there are two things in the new McCain strategy that stretch the bounds of credulity. The first one is Sarah Palin was the most qualified Republican to be vice president, the vice president to a president who would be the oldest person ever elected to the office and somebody with a pretty serious history of cancer. So the normal story about vice president is a heartbeat away from the presidency. In this case, you have to take that very seriously. So McCain and Palin over the next 2 months are going to have to convince the American public that, in fact, she is made of presidential stuff. And I was just watching her interview with Charlie Gibson on ABC News, that I'm sure is now going to get flashed around the world, where he was asking her some tough questions, and I thought she did okay. But, of course, there was no policy substance there. It was much more how do you feel kind of stuff. The second challenge McCain is going to have is to be able to say that he's a change agent when his two core policies are straight Bush policies. That is, defend the Bush tax cuts, which differentially benefited wealthy Americans, even if you believe they had trickle-down effects that were positive for the whole country. They certainly reduced the tax burden on what we might call the super rich in the U.S. And the second policy, of course, is he's a stronger supporter of the Iraq War even than George Bush. So how can one not be Bush 3 if those are your two key policies? But at the moment, McCain is winning this battle, and the old, you know, this old force of momentum, the momentum has just swung remarkably away from Obama. And I'm sure what the Obama campaign is thinking desperately about is how can they get back the excitement that surrounded his candidacy in May and June, but that they lost in July and August. That's the challenge for them. Okay, so I don't know, I'm not sure anyone knows who's going to be the next president, but I do think it's important to speculate a little bit about what it might mean for the rest of the world. And here, my fundamental theme is one that I don't know whether this is a deflating theme. I would consider it a realistic theme. And the realistic is that the constraints that the next president of the United States will face are so deep that one shouldn't expect a McCain or Obama presidency to be so different. And two, the things that the next president does might actually disappoint a lot of people around the world, including in Australia. So let me see if I can make those cases quickly. In terms of constraints, this idea that the next president will be constrained, I think there is no doubt that the two highest priorities of the next president must be trying to do something to reverse the worst economic downturn in the U.S. in a generation, and second, extending and expanding, not reducing, the global war on terrorism or the struggle against Islamic extremism. So the first point about economics, I guess, is in some ways trivially true, which is that it's the issue that most Americans care about. The president actually probably doesn't have much ability to affect the direction of the American economy. Things like technological change, global markets, and the Federal Reserve in the U.S. are much more important to the economy than the president. But nonetheless, the president must signal to the country that he cares about middle America, and middle America is hurting. So that's the first challenge. Do something, be seen to do something about the economy. Why do I think the war on terrorism agenda is going to expand, not diminish? There is an elite consensus in the U.S. that's emerging that one doesn't hear about so often, but I think it's clearly there, on Iraq. And the Iraq consensus is the U.S. will draw down its troop numbers in Iraq considerably, maybe even close to on the timetable that Obama suggested, by late 2010, but that the U.S. will keep in Iraq, assuming the Iraqis will allow it, a garrison kind of force on a South Korea model of probably several tens of thousands of troops into the indefinite future. So when one thinks about parallels and metaphors for what the U.S. is going to do in Iraq, I think a Vietnam-style exit, a precipitous exit, is not in the cards. What's much more in the cards is a managed U.S. presence over the long term. So think South Korea, not Vietnam, when it comes to Iraq. Barack Obama was very smart to do a less Iraq, more Afghanistan pivot a couple of months ago in terms of his foreign policies. It was very smart for him because he needed to square a difficult circle, which was the American public is sick to death of Iraq, just like the rest of the world is. But he needed to prove that he was tough on national security and not just the most dovish of presidents. So what Obama said was, listen, Iraq, I've told you from the beginning that Iraq was the wrong war, but Afghanistan's the right war. And what will happen under an Obama presidency is we'll pay much more attention to Afghanistan. I think that's probably true, but I think it underestimates a few facts that's going to make it very hard for the U.S. to make an Iraq-like commitment to Afghanistan. Iraq has cost so much money. The American military is so overstretched, and the country is so tired of warfare, it's just unrealistic to expect America to move 100,000 troops from Iraq into Afghanistan. What I think is much more likely to happen is that the next U.S. president, Barack Obama or John McCain, will say Afghanistan's the right war and our allies agree with us on that score, and what we'd like to do now is to ask our allies to play a much more active role in Afghanistan than they have in the past. And I'll return in a second to what I think that means for Australia. But the first thing I'd say about national security is that there will be a less Iraq, more Afghanistan pivot in the U.S., but Iraq's not going away. It's going to be managed. And the challenges of Afghanistan are at least as large as those in Iraq. Now one has to add to that the fact that unstable and increasingly anti-American Pakistan must clearly be tackled at the same time as Afghanistan. These are not either-or countries. One must think about them at the same time. In addition to that, the issue of Iran's nuclear ambitions is not going away. It's going to become a more important issue for the U.S. going forward, if for no other reason than Israelis believe fervently that Iran is an existential threat to their country. That's not going to go away. I wouldn't predict, and we must all surely hope it never transpires, that there will be some kind of armed conflict between Israel, preemptive airstrikes or anything of the like, from Israel into Iran, or without overt support from the United States. But I think it's unrealistic on the other side to expect that a pure diplomacy approach to Iran is going to continue into the indefinite future either. So just summarizing all that, it seems to me that the war on terrorism agenda is getting bigger, not smaller. Instead of being, as it's been in the U.S. for the past 5 years, all Iraq all the time, the agenda will now have Iraq, Iran, Pakistan, and Afghanistan in it. So the next president is going to have to deal with all of that stuff plus this economic downturn. That's a pretty tough agenda for anybody to take on in 4 years, and that's what the president's going to have to take on. What does it mean for Australia? I wrote a piece that just came out in The Diplomat a couple of weeks ago, I think, where I had a pithy little rendering of this, so you'll have to excuse me for reading it verbatim. I said that these sober realities will bring unwanted news for Australians a little too giddy on Obama hype. I wrote this, by the way, before this poll came out. More pressure for Australia to be a bigger player in Afghanistan than Australia wants. Less leadership on climate change than Australia covets. Less interest in Asia than Australia expects. And the rising protectionism that Australia fears. So I had four pointed things to say where I would argue. I'd say that it's likely that Australia's hopes for the next president are likely not to be met. So let me just go through those, grouping them together in two basic groups. War on terrorism. I guess my expectation would be that Kevin Rudd is going to face decisions on how and when to support the U.S. in the war on terrorism agenda that will end up being just about as tough as those that John Howard faced, and that the first such test will be whether and how Prime Minister Rudd decides to increase Australia's presence in Afghanistan in 2009. And I think that the decision will have to come quite early, because you can bet that the next US president will come calling on Prime Minister Rudd to live up to his commitment that Australia's in Afghanistan in a serious way and for the long haul. What that would mean in terms of Australian troop presence, I don't know, and I'm not an expert on Australian military, so I don't know what the capacity of the military would be. I just make the observation which is that I don't think that the war on terrorism issues that obviously were such a challenge for the Howard government are going to go off the table in 2009. I think there'll be new challenges for the Rudd government to face, beginning in Afghanistan, but maybe extending to Iran and some other countries as well. So that would be my first point, that because Europe and Canada in particular really have no stomach for a bigger involvement in Afghanistan, Australia is going to be called on to be the US's number one ally there. And I don't know how this country will respond to that call, but it's my expectation that it will come. The second group of things that I'd say, and I will end here, is that because of the constraints that the U.S. is going to be under, some of the more sort of visionary leadership things that one might hope for from the next American president are probably not likely to materialize. So I think for an Australian audience, the most obvious one of those to point to has to do with climate change. In the U.S., the issue isn't climate change. It's energy independence. And energy independence means a few things to Americans, but it doesn't mean fighting greenhouse gas emissions. Energy independence means reducing dependence on Middle Eastern oil, promoting alternative energy and or more offshore oil drilling in the U.S., and improving the American economy. That's what energy independence is. It's not a concern for the global environment in nearly the same way as is the case in Australia. So, I do not expect the U.S., even under Barack Obama or John McCain, both of whom, by the way, at least in word, are much greener than George W. Bush was, I wouldn't expect either American president to be a leader at the Copenhagen summit next year on creating a global emissions trading scheme. I also do not expect either president to propose an emissions trading scheme for the United States. What I would expect is that the next president will talk up energy independence a lot, and that the way they talk it up will vary depending on who is in the seat. If it's John McCain, he will talk more about oil and gas drilling and making sure that the U.S. uses all of its own domestic energy resources before going offshore for oil and gas. If it's Barack Obama, Barack Obama will talk much more about alternative energy, but he'll talk about it as investments that America should make in alternative energy that will create jobs at home. And if you go back and look at Obama's acceptance speech at the Democratic Convention, that's exactly what he said. He also said, by the way, that offshore oil drilling in the U.S. should be part of any sensible American energy plan. So if you put all that together in the midst of an economic downturn, I don't think it's realistic to expect American leadership on climate change. The U.S. is going to be a much more inward-looking country than that kind of visionary leadership, than something like leadership on climate change would require. I think that also holds for a global free trade agenda and or community building in the Asia-Pacific region, two things that are clearly extremely important to Australia. The U.S. has become quite a protectionist country in the past several years. In a famous headline survey late last year in the Wall Street Journal, the journal reported with considerable dismay that 60% of the American population believes that free trade has been bad for the country. That was before the full effects of the current economic downturn trickled out to the country as a whole. The U.S. collectively as a country is going to be in no mood to champion global free trade agreements, regional free trade agreements, bilateral free trade agreements in 2009. That doesn't mean that the Australia-U.S. free trade agreement is in any jeopardy. That's just not in the cards. But I don't think one can look to the U.S. to solve the intractable problems of Doha, or to push for an APEC free trade area, or anything like that. The country just isn't going to move in that direction. The second thing that I think is true is that even though the rise of Asia, emerging Asia in the longer run, over the sweep of the 21st century, is surely the most important phenomenon that we're all living through, it doesn't make it high enough on the American political agenda for it to be a priority for the next American president. What the president will probably do is continue what I would consider to be broad brushstrokes, the policies of George W. Bush with respect to Asia, which is a somewhat wary working realpolitik coexistence with China. So one doesn't embrace China, one doesn't castigate China, one works with China on a case-by-case basis, coupled with an effort to balance China's power in other ways, most notably by support of the civilian nuclear deal with India, which many people believe is undermining global non-proliferation efforts. So U.S. policy to Asia is a sort of, I'd say two things about it, I guess. One, it's realpolitik. Two, it's a second-order consideration. It's not a top-drawer policy concern for America, and I don't think that'll change. Lest my assessment of the U.S. in 2009 seem too gloomy, I think it's incredibly important to remind myself and you all that there's a lot more to America than the foreign policy that comes out of Washington. In particular, the dynamism of the American private sector is not going away. In fact, it's expanding. American multinational firms are doing more things in more complex ways in more countries than ever before, and I actually think that that's really good for the world. It's not only good for the U.S. economy, it creates more ties across national boundaries that ultimately is going to be good for freedom, peace, prosperity, all the things we care about. Let me see if I can make that case very briefly. If you look at Silicon Valley, information and communications technologies, you know, it's certainly true that Apple and Google and all these firms we know about have made a boatload of money. But I think it's probably also true that it's those firms that are doing more for political openness than the policies of governments, you know, condemning China for human rights problems and other things in the long run, or countries in the Middle East, simply because the diffusion of technology is almost irresistible. So that's a sort of backward-looking thing. Forward-looking, if one cares about climate change, I would predict that the innovation, that Silicon Valley has changed its focus in the past 5 years from IT to alternative energy. All of the focus of America's most creative minds and its most creative capital at the moment is on alternative energy. Why is that? A lot of it has to do with the fact that they think that's where the money is going to be made, but some of it is probably a little more altruistic. So if I was thinking about how the U.S. will affect the global environment, I would think less about whether the U.S. signs on or plays a leadership role in a global emissions trading scheme than the dynamism of the American venture capital and innovation community to try to tackle the problems through technological change. And by the way, that's what Barack Obama said in his speech at the convention when he said he was going to commit $150 billion to alternative energy under his presidency. The last thing I'd say about this, and I will end here, is that if one cares about China, let me put it this way. There's no one in the U.S. who cares more about China than American multinational firms, because they know that that's where their future is. What they've decided to do, however, is to stay below the political radar and just to try to do more and more business, integrating the American and Chinese economies more and more in the past several years, rather than get in political fights. I think because they believe the political fight is not a winnable one. And they're probably right about that. Because the reality is that America, like Australia, is losing manufacturing jobs that are probably not going to come back. And that multinational firms know that. So what they're doing is slicing up the global value chain, excuse the business school lexicon, so that things are invented and marketed and financed in the West, but they're assembled and made in the developing world, and increasingly they're not being sent back to the U.S. or Australia. They're going to be sold in China. I think that's a pretty good thing, but it will require political leadership to explain to regular folks why that way of the future is good for them. And when I talk about this in the U.S., particularly if there are a lot of young people in the audience, I always sort of say, pull out your iPod and take a look at the back of your Apple product, or your iPhone maybe now in Australia. Steve Jobs, the head of Apple, is a marketing genius. And if you look on the back of the Apple, of any Apple product, it doesn't say made in China, even though in conventional terms all Apple products are made in China. What it says is designed in California, assembled in China. And then he doesn't say for sale in China as well, but that's increasingly the case. And that's the way of the future, and that side of the United States is becoming ever more global, even at a time when I think there's a tendency to insularity, inward-lookingness, because of anxiety in the country. So there's a bit of a yin and a yang there, but I do think at the headline level, the world, with all its expectations for change in 2009, is setting itself up for a bit of a disappointment, because we're probably likely to see more continuity than change, I think, in 2009. And I will stop there.
We have time for some questions. I should say, to start with, though, that I'll be cutting questions off right on time, and we have to whisk the good professor away to another engagement. So we'll have to make them brief, concise and to the point. And could I ask the questioners to gallop to the microphones at the side of the hall there so we can record your questions.
I think I might have put everybody to sleep during my remarks.
See you. When you were talking about Sarah Palin, who's obviously the issue of the moment, you were saying that you thought that perhaps she was a short-term bump for McCain in terms of whether he's likely to be elected or not, like the dead man's bump, I heard it described. But there is only 2 months till the 4th of November, so Do you get the feeling that that bump will last long enough that will tip him over the line?
The answer is I don't know, but it's surely if you were thinking about what are the biggest questions that will determine the final result, you know, that's probably in the top two or three for me. Can Palin withstand what will be the withering intensity of questioning of her understanding of the world, I think, is going to be an enormous question, and the questioning has already started. Of course, I do think that, you know, what used to be the most boring event in the entire calendar, the vice presidential debate, is now likely to be one of the world's most watched political debates. And of course, the difficult thing there is going to be for the arrogant Joe Biden to be able to resist the temptation to talk down to Sarah Palin, because that would be the worst thing he could possibly do. So Biden in that debate is going to have to project all his knowledge of the world without ever appearing to talk down to Palin, and that'll be tough for him. It might be tough for anybody, but I think it might be tougher for Joe Biden than for most. And then, of course, on Palin's side, clearly what they're going to do is try to school her up as quickly as possible, so that the fact that her international experience until last year extended to Canada, which one must go through to get back to the continental U.S., and Mexico. I don't know whether she went to Puerto Vallarta or something for a vacation, but I'd be trying to get out of Alaska if I could in the winter. So that's one. The second one is, can McCain credibly continue to run as a change agent when his policies look, if you shed away the gloss, his policies look pretty conventional Bush-style policies? Can he continue to win the change game from Obama? But then third and most important, I think, is, can Obama do something to recapture the buzz that surrounded him a couple of months ago? Because as I said, I don't think one should date McCain's ascendance to his decision to pick Palin. I think that the change in the dynamic of the campaign predated that, and it was Obama's decision to become much more of a conventional Democrat that made all this possible for McCain. And so now the question is, I'm sure, something the Obama people are asking themselves on a second-by-second basis: what can we do to get the magic back for our candidate? So those would be the big three. I don't know how they're going to break. And, of course, events in the real world might have a big impact. Something that happens internationally in the U.S., the Georgia-Russia crisis became an overnight, oh, my God, what have we forgotten about? Is the Cold War back? Something like that, or the failure of a very large American financial institution like Lehman Brothers, the campaign. But I think the three questions that I enunciated are the ones that are likely to determine ultimately who wins.
Thank you.
Now, I think the gentleman on the right might have been first.
Lawson Love, there's, of course, another election or set of elections that takes place in November. That's the election for the Senate, the House of Reps, and indeed governors.
Yes.
The Republicans, from your analysis, would probably be expected to do less well in that outcome. First of all, do you comment on that? And secondly, what effect will possibly a stronger Democratic Congress have on either president, Obama or McCain?
Well, your supposition, I think, is entirely correct. That is that the Democrats will do very well in the congressional elections because the Republican Party as a party now is at least as unpopular as President Bush in the U.S. at the moment. There have been some stunning local election results confirming that. What it'll mean ultimately, it would mean obviously that both presidents, potential presidents, would be pretty heavily constrained in their legislative agenda by what Congress would go for. And a Democratic Congress is likely to want as much support for middle America as they can possibly get in an environment where it's going to be hard for the country to pay for that. So I guess if you forced me to make predictions about domestic policy, my prediction would be quite a few things that are of big symbolic value, but probably not as much of substance. On the foreign policy side, it's always the case that there tend to be battles between Congress and the executive branch, irrespective of whoever is holding power on both sides. And I would expect those to continue. But at the end of the day, it's what the president says that goes in foreign affairs, including decision to commit troops. So I'm not sure that Congress will affect foreign policy so much, with the exception of things that have to be ultimately be ratified by treaty, such as new economic agreements, free trade agreements. And there, as I said, I don't expect much action because I don't think the country's in a place to embrace free trade and globalization. It's feeling insular, inward-looking, and anxious at the moment.
Now, gentleman over on the left-hand side here.
Yes, thank you. I'm sorry. I apologise for having missed the beginning of your speech, and you may have covered this point quite adequately. But
I'm not sure I covered any points adequately, so if I get a chance to try again, I would like to take the opportunity.
Thank you. I think a lot of us have a really simple background worry, feeling about this election. That is that Senator Obama may have come a little bit too early, and that when it comes to the day, America is still not prepared to put a non-white in the White House.
I think it would be naive to believe that race is not a factor. How big of a factor race is with respect to Obama, I'm not sure. But I did make the observation, I hope I made it clearly, I'll try to do so again, that it's my feeling that the reason Barack Obama is not solidly 10 points ahead in the opinion polls, which is what the state of the economy and the unpopularity of the president would predict, is that the country is not convinced in a time when it's anxious that they can risk putting Barack Obama in the White House. Now, some of that might have to do with race, some of it might have to do with age, some of it might have to do with lack of experience, but I think the additional thing there that Obama, the one thing that Obama can do, he can't change his race, he can't change his age, he can't change his inexperience, but he can connect with the American people in the form of a narrative about who he is that they can understand. And I don't think he's done that effectively thus far. If you go back and look at the convention acceptance speeches, for example, the strongest part of McCain's speech by far was when he was talking about the changes that literally went through him as a person during his incarceration in the Vietnam War. You know, I went from thinking about myself to knowing that I had to serve and thank my country. If you look at the Obama speech, all Obama said was, McCain tells you I'm a celebrity, but I'm going to tell you that my heroes are my regular working mother and grandparents. And then when he went for the soaring oratory, it wasn't oratory about him. It was oratory about John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King, clearly his two heroes and the people he's most often compared to. But it had this feeling that, it, to me at least, that it was a bit distant, that he understands full well what's inspiring, but he can't do this is who I am thing in a way that regular folks go for. And interestingly, this is an observation, the sort of who is Barack Obama question is something that both the left and the right in the U.S. concentrate on. So there was a fascinating, typically lengthy, but fascinating story in the New Yorker a couple of months ago where a New Yorker columnist went to Chicago to go and discover Barack Obama's roots, because Chicago has a famous black political machine on the Democratic side. And the person was just struck by the fact that no one in the black Chicago Democratic political machine had very nice things to say about Obama, because they didn't think he was one of them. He didn't earn his stripes there, he didn't stay there, and he doesn't go back there. He shot meteorically through that world, and then he spent a couple of years in Springfield in the state assembly, and then he was in Washington, and now he's running for president. He hasn't been there long enough for people to know. So it's a long-winded way of saying one should not discount residual racial considerations in this election, but I think there's a lot more going on with this seeming unwillingness of middle America to embrace Obama than just race.
Okay, now there's a questioner on the right here.
This question sort of reflects concerns that I've found when talking to my students and other people, teachers. One of the issues that you didn't touch on, as I understand it, like George W. Bush gets a lot of support from the Christian right in America, which is an area that, as I understand, McCain hasn't been specifically courting in his campaign. But because Sarah Palin is an evangelical Christian, and there's been a couple of articles I've read published about her background and her religious beliefs and such like that, do you think there's an opportunity that McCain can use that to mobilise the Christian right in America to vote for him? I suppose that I see that as an issue because there are like single issue votes for things like about, you know, abortion, stem cell research, same-sex marriage, which all have a religious moral dimension. Do you think that could be a factor in the upcoming election?
Yes, a couple of. I mean, one could muse on this for a long time, but let me make a couple of pointed comments. The first one is that the religious right is solidly in the Republican camp and would have been quote unquote trapped to vote for McCain anyway. But if one goes back to the 2004 election, the re-election of George Bush, it wasn't actually the religious right. It was the so-called security moms who ended up being the critical constituency. That was middle-class women driving their children to soccer games, not the hockey games that, by the way, the ice hockey games that Sarah Palin talks about. I grew up playing what Americans call field hockey. The things get lost in translation across continents, I find, even when the language is notionally the same. The 2004 was security moms. It was a post 9/11 overhang. I think that sort of morphed more into a more general sense of anxiety now. And, you know, that's a constituency that is hard for Obama to win, because Obama's core support bases are African Americans and 18 to 29s who otherwise wouldn't participate in politics, who are just so excited by this guy. So I think he might be losing some of them. The Palin thing was more about, and again, some people would consider this completely cynical, and opportunist and short-term, maybe all those things, but it was about the Hillary Clinton voters, because McCain could read the polls as well as anybody else with all of these people who voted for Hillary Clinton, mostly women, in the Democratic primary saying they just couldn't come to vote for Obama. Now, you know, hard for them to vote for McCain. Maybe it's easier when there's a woman on the ticket. Who knows how that'll play? But I think the, you know, it has been the case that women have, when Democrats have won, they've won on the backs of women votes. 2004, John Kerry didn't do nearly as well among women as he needed. If Barack Obama doesn't do well, that won't augur well for him.
Okay, I think you'd have to agree we've had full answers. Could you please join me in thanking our lecturer today?
Thank you very much.
That was very good.